You're listening to a Bucks Plus audio production on the Bucks Plus Network.
Your weekly pulse on the Milwaukee Bucks, straight from a Bucks legend. This is Here District with Marcus Johnson, alongside his son and 1995 NCAA champion, Chris. Here's MJ.
All right, welcome everybody to Here District. I'm the captain of this vessel. My first mate, Chris Johnson. Chris Johnson and I are the only father and son tandem, Sam Amick, to win a national championship at the same school. There's been others that have won national championships. We hold the unique distinction of being the only father and son duo to win a championship at the same school, and that would, of course, be UCLA. We are
Go Bruins.
So pleased to welcome a senior writer for The Athletic, a very, very informative, entertaining, and just elite-level insights into the world of sports, all sports really, but basketball. I really, really love a bunch of you guys out there, what you do at The Athletic. And Sam Amick is a senior NBA writer. Sam, welcome to Here District, man. Just a pleasure to have you. We're honored.
Marcus, Chris, thank you so much. I mean, what I'm hearing here, you know, I was at the Lakers-Wolves game the other day, and with all due respect to LeBron and Bronny, like, this is the father-son duo that, that we should be talking.
Who? Well, you know, since you started right there, I'm going to ask you your opinion on that. What is the Sam Amick professional / personal take? I mean, you hear so many detractors talking about Bronny, and there's a bunch of lip readers out there that are reading lips from different guys around the league. And what's your feeling about that?
So I feel like my feelings are evolving a little bit. I told somebody this morning, we were talking about it. So I have two sons, and I, you know, for the most part, I had been in the camp that says, you know what? I mean, whether you call it nepotism or whatever you want to call it, like, that's part of the league. Like, we can go to every franchise. And honestly, the Bucks get brought up when it's like, okay, the Giannis Thanasis thing, like, it's part of it. But I thought it was incredibly special and you know, meaningful that those guys were going to be able to play together. So I go to the game and I see the moment. And I think where I've kind of evolved, which not probably as warm and fuzzy and positive, is that the father in me now feels like I just don't know that if I was his son that I would want to be coworkers with my dad at this point of my career. You know, every single day, my son, for example, my oldest, you know, like if I hung out with him for a year, I'm gonna probably nitpick the hell out of him because I can't help myself. I'm his dad, you know. And I just hope that he has a productive, healthy beginning to his professional basketball life, especially when it obviously is just not very organic. This is, you know, he would not be on the Lakers if his father was not LeBron James. I think he'd have a crack at the league, but it's just a very different experience because of who his dad is.
Well, and so with transparency in mind, you know, when Chris was just out of UCLA or coming out of UCLA. I mean, Chris, you know, I made some calls, man. I got, you know, Kiki Vanderway, Minnesota's camp, Atlanta, where you should have made the team, but an ankle injury with the last couple of days of that camp kind of sidelined. I'm trying to be a free agent, trying to go against guaranteed contracts. But, you know, as fathers, Sam, as to your point, you know, we do what we can. Chris's son, my grandson Will, you know, he wants to get into basketball on some level, played at Oregon as a walk-on for Dana Altman and those great teams up there, along with Peyton Pritchard, some other great pros. So, you know, we do what we can. And so I have no misgivings at all. And yes, you know, this is something that only a select individual can do. But LeBron James is that select individual, right? I mean, if anybody could pull this off, right, LeBron's right. Probably the only guy that could.
Right. Well, and again, to keep it with the Milwaukee filter, you know, if Liam Antetokounmpo was a little older, I think Giannis would have no problem getting him, you know, a crack at the NBA. And that part I haven't had a problem with. It's just more so now my focus goes to Bronny and you know, I hope they get him in the G League soon enough and let him start developing, you know, like, cause I don't think being a cheerleader on the bench and having the cameras on you to study every facial expression, you know, every single night in that kind of a spotlight is the way to go.
Well, I got a barber in L.A. He's from Milwaukee. G the barber, and he's got some kind of parlay bet. I'm not a big gambler, but there's this bet going on that Bronny will score 20 points in a game this year, or make 4 3-pointers. So he's got a bet riding on both of those. And I think he's got it. You know, Bronny had 17 points in garbage time in an exhibition game. It just depends on the situation. So, but speaking of Giannis, man, you've had a lot of conversations or some conversations with him. I know you were out in Irvine for Camp Connect with the Bucks, and just your take on Giannis, where he is right now. He'll turn 30 in December. Man, it's been 10 years, Sam, since I've been here, and he was just 19 going on 20 at the time. Been remarkable watching his development as a person, as a man. But we hear every year or so how – you know, what the Bucks need to do to keep him in Milwaukee. Do you really think, as embedded in this community as he is, that's something that this team needs to be concerned about?
It's funny because from the inside out, I can certainly understand why the answer might be no. Admittedly, as somebody who covers the league nationally, I always end up feeling, and I'm just being super honest, like guilty over the fact that part of our job is to talk to folks all around the league. And so if you know, I guess to paint the picture about the time I spent with the Bucks at camp was when I started talking to Giannis, and we know each other pretty well, and he's been good to me over the years, and I really enjoy our interactions. I said to him, like, listen, I'm not trying to come in hot, but the other day I was talking to another team and I was a little bit surprised that, like, when I just generally asked them, like, what's on your radar this year in terms of things that you're monitoring, things that honestly, as a media guy, that you think that I should be paying attention to, I didn't expect Giannis's name to come up, and had, you know, even after that, ran into it a couple more times where now, so because other teams, like, big shocker, right? Like, other teams would love to employ Giannis Antetokounmpo. But the premise there is that, and it's all hypothetical, of course, is that if you look at the combination of, you know, their payroll sheet, of their, you know, last couple of years not being as great as they were hoping they would be, where Giannis is at in his career, that you know, these other teams are getting the slightest bit hopeful that if it doesn't go well in Milwaukee, that he might raise his hand and say, you know, I think I want to get out of here. Now, that's obviously outside noise. To Giannis's credit, what I did, and this is a rare thing in this business in today's day and age, what I did appreciate so much is that, A, he didn't give me a hard time for asking a fairly on-the-nose question, and B, like, because he's got a great personality, he decided to handle it with a fair amount of humor, where he kind of just leaned into it and said, listen, and you guys read the piece, and I was busting up as he went through it. He grabs the shoulder of a nearby staff member who just happened to be walking by and jokingly but with a point said, you know, hey, do you worry about, are you getting fired if we don't play well this year? And eventually Giannis's point was like, listen, we all know this is pro sports. We know that it comes with pressure. We know that it comes with expectation, and that when things don't go the way you want it to go, sometimes there is change. So that's a long answer to the question. You know, my opinion is that, you know, hypothetically, if we got to next summer and the landscape didn't look all that promising. Let's say Dame had another tough year and maybe he wasn't loving the experience out there. And, you know, he didn't have the kind of support around him being Giannis that he thought he needed, then never say never. I mean, I've seen stranger things, but, you know, we all know he loves that community. We all know how invested the organization has been in him. You know, I had another executive tell me, like, Sam, like, you've been in Milwaukee lately? Like, he's on every billboard. He owns the city. Like, you know, this person, like, I have a hard time seeing him want to get outside of that. So, you know, we'll see.
Sam, I was wondering, like, with all the talk this preseason about Giannis nationally, right, and the Bucks, a lot of folks had them, somebody had him seventh, I believe it was Bleacher Report, to finish in the East, fifth, fourth. Do you get a sense that Giannis is going into this season placing, like, a crazy amount of pressure on himself to win a championship?
I do, but I don't think it's because of the conversation around him. I think it's, and he talked about this a bit. I think it's his own internal drive, his competitiveness, his age. You know, he had a very, very open, candid comment, and I'm paraphrasing here, but where he said, you know, you don't want to look up and be 35, 36, 37 and be wondering why you didn't accomplish what you wanted to accomplish. So, you know, he knows that he's not a young man anymore, but he is in the middle of his prime and he's still, you know, in the conversation for best player on the planet. So that pressure to win a championship, I think it's honestly not more complicated than the fact that when he won it the first time, he's talked about this, like it was a drug that he thought, it almost sounded like he thought that once he got a taste of it, it would be like enough, like, and that was not the case. Like, you know, days, minutes after he won the first one, you know, he was surprised by the desire to say, I don't want to go back. And, you know, and that was partly what I said to him too. Like, you know, I went and covered the Olympics. I was lucky enough to be in France, and watching him dominate the way he did over there, that's where my wheels started turning. And you're kind of reminding yourself like, man, we are sleeping on this dude again. So I think he wants to go out and remind people who he is. And you can't do that unless you dominate in the East, and you got to be in the conversation as a title contender.
And so you talk about that Olympic experience. He played for Spanoulis, was his coach, I believe how you pronounce that, which yeah. You know, just reading some of the stuff about this guy, I mean, he's a hard-driving guy. He was demanding, you know, more of Giannis when Giannis thought he was given as much as he could give. He would call him on the carpet for being a better defensive player. I say that to say, Sam, there was a situation before the championship year. So we're in Indianapolis at IUPUI, where George Hill went to school, practicing.
Yep.
But putting the team through some offensive stuff. And he told Giannis, he said, Giannis, I've been watching film, and you need to get off the ball more and get off the ball quicker, you know, when teams send two and three defenders at you. So the very next couple of possessions, Giannis, in practice, in a lightweight scrimmage, controlled scrimmage, Sam, Chris, Giannis didn't look to shoot for about two or three possessions. I'll never forget this. Coach Bud stopped practice and just lit into Giannis and said, God dang it, Giannis, just because, you know, don't be a big baby. Just because I say pass the ball doesn't mean I don't want you to look to shoot the ball at all. Stop being a baby. And so Katie George, who was our sideline reporter, she looked at me and I told her, just, you know, pretend you didn't hear it. Just keep your head down. Keep writing. Just pretend. But my point is, you know, is Doc Rivers, do you think Doc is the guy? I know Giannis has a lot of respect for him. Do you think Doc has that kind of, can have that kind of impact on him? Just getting the best out of a player. What you know, the kind of coach that Giannis needs to get the best out of him?
I mean, I feel like maybe the jury's out. You know, some of the conversations I had with Doc at camp, and it was somewhat brief, but we did connect a bit. You know, he did sound like somebody who was going to shoot straight. He talked about Damian Lillard, for example, and how, I'm trying to remember the specifics of this example, but they've been studying like each player's points per possession in transition, right? And basically just, you know, they have multiple guys who can bring the ball up the floor. And one of the things they ran into last year was that, you know, whoever didn't bring up the floor or bring the ball up the floor just was not running enough and was basically pouting on the wings, you know, because these guys are also used to having the ball. This is a little bit, you know, Marcus, like your story from IUPUI, like whoever didn't have the rock was in their feelings and just kind of like taking their time. Doc's point is we got to be like fighter jets all the way down the floor, and that's going to be an advantage. So he is delivering tough messages to the team. Honestly, if, you know, I mean, it wasn't my intent, but if I could help Doc feel any better about like Giannis's willingness to hear the tough talk, like he should read the piece where he talks about Spanoulis, because to hear Giannis detail the way that Spanoulis would call him out on the carpet said a lot about the way Giannis wants to be coached right now. You know, the other story that he shared was I think it was Team Canada. They lose the game, and Giannis says, you know, I felt like I left my heart on the floor. I left my kidney, everything, like my knee. It was all out there. And this guy walks up to me and says, You know, I didn't feel that fire and that intensity on the defensive end. And my other, I think this was in the piece, but I thought it was so funny that you got Spanoulis, who is a legend. He's a Greek legend. But let's not get it twisted. Like, his resume does not compare at all to Giannis Antetokounmpo. But regardless, him having the audacity to joke with Giannis and say, hey, listen, buddy, when he told him, he says, when I was 29 years old, I was winning back-to-back championships. Now, they were EuroLeague titles. That doesn't, you know, that's impressive, but it's not an NBA championship. But he was finding ways to get under Giannis's skin and motivate him. And it seems like it worked. And it seems like, you know, to your question about Doc, that Giannis wants more of that.
We saw last night, just on both sides of the ball, was a renewed sense of purpose from the Bucks. They played like they, you know, put something on it, like something's on it for them. They took it serious. I was trying to get your vantage point on that. But to go back to Spanoulis and talk about just that direct style, is like accountability is what the sense I get is like, you know, at the core of Spanoulis' style. How Yep. much of that type of style is transferable in today's NBA?
I mean, generally speaking, it's a tough road to hoe, right? I'll bring the Lakers up. I just was around the Lakers. And even if J.J. Redick is successful, like, we all know that part of J.J.'s appeal is like the rapport that he can have with players. But that, I think, is a reflection of the sensitivity or the delicate nature of the coach-player relationship that an organization would go after a guy like J.J. with the hopes that you can be partners with the players more than, you know, kind of a more militaristic coach, honestly, like Spanoulis appears to be. With Giannis and these Bucks, maybe the time is right to have, you know, that sort of old school approach, because they are now a couple years removed from the title. We in the media we obviously don't talk about them the way we used to. You know, when they won that title, you kind of wondered if they had another one in the following year. And Giannis, again, he enjoyed the kind of the fruits of his labors, and those are gone now. And so, and that's the stuff that I think, and Dame's another one. I mean, Dame's obviously significantly older than Giannis. And I mean, to speak frankly about Dame, I think it's an incredibly important year for him. If he's not a good fit this year, and if they don't win a ton of ball games, we are absolutely going to be talking about what that means after this season. So, you know, like, Giannis is one thing. He's deeper in the community. Dame, we all know the story. Like, he thought he was going to Miami. You know, he's embraced this challenge and he's in a better place now. But I think it could work in Milwaukee to have that style now because of, you know, the pressure and the stakes and what these guys want and where they want to get back to.
Yeah, and, you know, you're talking about the old school style of coaching, and my old coach, John Wooden, I was doing some international coaching one summer down in Belize and Dominican Republic, and I asked him before he passed away, right before he died in whenever that was, 2010, around June 4th, I believe. But right before that, I asked Coach. I said, Coach, what's the key to being a good coach, to you know, just reaching your players in terms of having them execute the way you want them to? And so what's the key? And he told me very simply, Sam, he said, you got to love your players. You got to love your players. Now, with that, in the context of Doc Rivers and old school. So Doc, from my observation, Sam, I mean, not only does he kick them in the butt when they need to, but he is so good at patting them on the back and lifting them up and joking with them and laughing with them and keeping the levity and keeping the lightness. Doc, I mean, just watching him, Sam, he's a master people person in terms of managing personalities. And so from that standpoint, I think he will have a lot of success. And remember the Bucks in terms of the last 2 years and the futility of the playoff. It's injuries. I mean, Giannis goes down the last couple of years in Miami after the first game or so. Last year didn't play at all. Dame goes. So Chris Middleton, all that. But to your point, I think it is a crucial season in terms of a bunch of long in the tooth. You know, $197 million payroll, the highest in the league. How important, Sam, and it was a great piece in The Athletic about, I think, the T.J. McConnells and the Jaden McDaniels and the Josh Harts, but the guys on the margins. I mean, talk about that in terms of where that is right now with the NBA and the importance of that.
No, it's huge. I mean, because of, you know, largely the way the new collective bargaining agreement was structured, you know, it is becoming a lot more of, and listen, these guys are all doing well, but it's the haves and the have nots in terms of, you know, the massive money going to the superstars and then, you know, an increased need to have some of your younger guys on rookie scale contracts actually contribute, you know, because the salaries end up being so top heavy, you know, and I agree that was a great piece that our guy Marcus Thompson wrote about the TJ McConnells of the world. And that's where some of these games are won. You know, you talk about fringes. I mean, it's those moments in the game when it comes down to one or two possessions. So, you know, for the Bucks, admittedly, you know, I got to learn more about that crew with them. I know there's some excitement about their rookie that dunked on Giannis's head during camp. There was a little buzz about that. And we'll see if they can show out. You know, it's obviously a unfortunate beginning of the season for Chris Middleton, where, you know, he's not a role guy. I mean, he's a core guy, but they need Chris to be Chris, and he's important. But yeah, those guys matter a lot, you know, especially over the course of 82 games when Giannis is going to take some nights off and guys are going to rest here and there, and you're still trying to improve that record. They matter a lot.
And to that point, Taurean Prince, I'm going to go out here on a limb. He is going to – I mean, I'm falling – I got this basketball crush on this dude right now. Just watching him play. No, man, just watching him play, Chris. I love what he does out there. He's as a cutter, I looked at his numbers last year. I mean, he was like a poor, below-average cutter, but he was like an excellent in the role game. So he understands how to get into space. It's like slipping in the darkness is what I refer to him as. He knows how to slip into those crevices. Gary Trent Jr., Sam, I think is going to be a major, major compliment to these guys. And DeLon Wright. You know, even DeLon Wright in terms of just what 13 minutes last night, I mean, that's going to be his role, 15, 20 minutes solid. A game, spelling Dame when he has to, playing alongside Dame at times. But I really believe, and as a general manager, man, I mean, John Horst, I mean, you've got to – well, what is it? Is it the general manager, or is it the fact that Doc has that kind of attraction to some of these players based on who he is, what he represents, what he's done? Where do you see that happening in terms of being able to pull in guys that the team was able to pull in for minimal amounts of money?
Yeah. No, I think you got to give them all a little shared credit. You know, John's got a very good track record, and we all know as far as John goes, like nobody wants his Dame move to work better than him, because that was one that he was celebrated for and obviously didn't work out as they had hoped last season. But John's track record is very strong. The Doc appeal, I think, is fair to highlight because, you know, guys who are in that kind of minimum salary range at that point, you know, they start paying attention to or thinking about the next contract. So they're trying to figure out where can I go to be valuable and then, you know, essentially kind of get myself back into the next salary tier the following season or a couple of years down the line. You know, that's what leads you to go to a place like Milwaukee, where you think the odds are pretty good that they can get back in the hunt again. So, you know, the Giannis appeal is a massive thing. He is a guy that I think players like to play with. You know what I mean? Like, there's plenty of players that are incredibly talented, but does everybody want to play with James Harden or Luka Doncic when, you know, it's a different style?
Or LeBron, for that fact. I mean, yeah. A lot of scuttlebutt about LeBron. The guy's not wanting to play with LeBron. So, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, Giannis, though, you know, from the locker room demeanor and the way he carries himself to, you know, the way they play on the floor and his energy, I guess, you know, there's a lot of, I think, things to like about what they have in Milwaukee. And obviously it got them a few good players on those edges.
All right, Sam. Well, hopefully it comes together, man. We appreciate you stopping by for a few moments just to talk NBA. And again, we really enjoy your work. Keep up all the good stuff that you're doing, man. And thanks for showing up here on the Here District, man. We appreciate you. Got to get you back further down the road.
Anytime, guys. This was fun. And don't let LeBron and Bronny steal your spotlight.
We'll not do that, Sam. Thank you, man. Appreciate you.
Thanks, guys.
All right, Sam Amick, we'll be back after a short break.
You're listening to a Bucks Plus audio production.
All right, welcome back here, District. This recording is happening after the Bucks won their first game on the road against a depleted Sixer basketball team. No Paul George, no Joel Embiid. So that's about what, Chris, about how many points? About almost 57 to 60
Probably
points
60.
On a given night. You know, 50.
Joel averaged 34 last year. PG go get you 25. So.
And Joel, I just saw where he was number two all time in points per 48 minutes a season. Points per 48 minutes. Guess who was number one?
Wilt.
Big Wilt, 1962.
All day. I'm going Wilt, bruh.
Yeah, but here's the interesting thing. Wilt averaged 50 points a game that season, right? He averaged 50 points a game that season, but he also averaged 48.5 minutes per game.
So his
48 points per minute actually go down.
Wow.
From 50 to like 48 or 40, because his minutes, you know, per 48 minutes, he played more than 48 minutes. And so his 50 point actually gets reduced to 48 somewhere, something or other, and change. And Joel Embiid's goes up to close to 48, I believe, from that 34 that he averaged. So just a fascinating, fascinating stat that I always like to throw out.
Does it trip you out that these guys in the NBA nowadays are scoring so many points in such little time? When you look at the minutes that these guys are getting, like, what do you think about that, and why does that happen?
Oh man, it goes back to usage. Yeah. And you look at some of the usage numbers, the percentage of possessions that a guy uses up, and so back in the day, and don't quote me on this, but I think Bird and Magic, if I don't know if they had a season where they had a 30% usage rate. And now it's 37,
it's norm,
38,
right?
36, you know, between Luka and Giannis and Jokic and these guys. Jokic's is really not all that, you know, just abnormally high. But so the ball's in their hands. And that's what I always tell people. If the ball was in Magic Johnson's hands, like it was in Giannis's hands the whole game, or Doncic's hands, and not knocking Doncic or Luka, they're great players, but Magic's numbers would have been even more
ridiculous.
Impressive. And Larry Bird's numbers would have been even more impressive than what they were. So that makes a big difference. But one thing that impressed me last night, Chris, was read and react, that Chris Middleton is not available, so he doesn't want to put in a whole lot of stuff, put in all our stuff, as coaches like to say. We got our stuff. We're going to run our stuff. Between that and ton, that's one of my buzzwords, man. I just cringe every time. Yeah, a ton of, he got a ton of, we got to put in a ton of, we got a ton of, we're doing a ton of, we got a ton of, we got a ton of, ton of.
I use ton all the time.
Hey, man, it's way overused, man. It's way overused.
Well,
yeah, he got a ton of jump shots. He played a ton of defense. You know, a ton of BS, man, with all that. Mess me with all that ton of stuff. Anyway, that's just my little personal picadillo here. I got a ton of picadillos. Anyway, but back to what I was saying. So this leads me into this new segment that, man, received rave reviews from this past week.
Really?
About that action. And that's, you know, about that action, boss. We about that action here on the Here District. And so what we're going to do, we're going to look at Doc and what he has really emphasized with this team in terms of read and react, just playing off each other. Just playing basketball. When I played for Don Nelson, we had a whole offensive scheme, Chris, called Just Play. And there were some basic rules, like, you know, big picks down for little back screens for big and pop. You don't have anything, you pass, you pick away, you get denied, you cut back door. You know.
Let me ask you this. What rules did Nelly have on guys spotting up behind the three-point line back then? I'm just curious. Were you guys all cutters, or was there one specific spotter that was able to chill behind the line?
Well, remember, the three-point shot was introduced into the NBA in 1979.
So let's say 1980 season. Okay, yeah. What's Nelly, what is Nelly talking about?
If we shot as a team, Chris, 53-pointers that year, I'd be surprised.
That's why.
I like to look that up. Maybe Motors can look that up. You know, as a team, that the first year that the 3-point line, second year 3-point line was in play. I know 100 would be out of reach. And now, like the Celtics shot, 60 plus in that first game, and teams are shooting 40 to 50. They want to get 50 up a game now. So,
but I think that the definition of just play, of playing basketball, has changed, has evolved, has morphed into something different with the three-point line. That's my only point with that.
Oh, no, it has to. And I got into this argument with a good friend of mine, Julian Page, the other night. He's talking about, man, they shooting too many dang-gone threes in the NBA, man. They have a layup and they'll kick it out. It's all about volume. We call him Tasmanian Devil. He's always mad about something, Julian Page.
Yeah.
But, man, all these damn threes, man. Marcus, why they shoot? I'm like, look, man, it's math, bro. It's math, you know, and the teams, and you look at the teams that shoot the most threes. The Celtics led the league last year, but, you know, you talk about some of these other teams. Dallas was right up there. I mean, the good teams are shooting a lot of threes. They're making it, and that's the thing that coaches are trying to figure out is how to generate more threes. You hear J.J. Redick talk about that with the Lakers. They shot a great percentage, but they only shot 30 a game or whatever it was.
That's his
big thing. And so to your point, so just play would evolve today into – you know, draw and kick basketball, but instead of a long two, get you behind the three-point line and spot up for a three-point shot. You look at a great shooter like a Junior Bridgman, now one of the owners of the Bucks, who we had on the show a couple of weeks ago. And as great a shooter as he was, he's one of the greatest shooters that I've ever seen in my life, Chris. But you look at his three-point numbers, you know, he may have shot 30% from the three-point line at the latter stages of his career, maybe a couple of times. You know, Larry Bird early on, he was always around the 22, 23%. So it just wasn't the thing back then. But the thing with us, the Bucks shot in 1979, 1980, the Bucks shot 155 threes that entire season. And Brian Winters probably shot the
so that's less than two threes a game.
Yeah,
that's
for the team.
That's crazy. That's just crazy.
Well, last season the Bucks shot 3,306 threes. So you kind of see where the game is gone, which makes it even more imperative to learn how to play off each other. So here's our segment about that action. Let's take a look, Chris. You jump in when you want, but watch this. Just playing. Freeze it right there. We freeze it right there. Now, you got two on the ball. You see the strong hedge. Look at Bobby Portis, Chris. It's the subtleties of off-ball movement that make things happen. So Bobby's going to take his man away from that left dunker area to the right side, which puts the pressure on that weak side defender. At the elbow. Now watch what he's got. Now it's two-on-one. Doctors talk the whole training camp about creating two-on-ones. Let's run it, get ready to stop it real quick, run it, right there. Now, it's a two-on-one. Brooke, if that defender doesn't stop him, he's going to keep coming, get to the basket for a dunk. If he shuts him down, he's got a kick to the corner for Taurean Prince, who was an outstanding corner three-point shooter, and let's run it through. And what happens? Defender commits, that lone defender, because Bobby Portis clear it out. Now you got a single tag guy on that weak side, and that puts a two-on-one in your favor. Now you just choose what's the advantage. So that's play number one. Let's look at the next play. And that's just playing out of just pick-and-roll action. And Brook Lopez, number two in the league in terms of short roller production last year. Now watch this. Here's Giannis. This is just Giannis in the open floor. There's a nice step-up screen. We're going to stop it right here. Right there. That's fine. Look at all eyes on me. Talk about Tupac. All eyes on me. Look at how many defenders are watching Giannis.
Five guys.
All five guys are watching Giannis. Now, whatever happened, you know, you talk about all the old school principles and how they're passe and all that. Whatever happened to ball, you man. Whatever happened to seeing it just doesn't exist as much in the game today. And I think it's something that's emphasized in camps. I don't know if it's because guys are more spread out. I'm not sure what the reasoning is, but you see this a lot. No vision of man whatsoever. Go ahead.
Well, everybody's spread out behind the three-point line, so I think that the evolution of help-side defense, no longer is it ball you man seeing both head on a swivel. It's we know that these guys are parking behind the line. So now, innately as a hooper, you know Kelly Oubre and my man, he knows he can go strong, close out to the corner. Kelly Oubre, I'm going close out to the wing or the top. You know what I'm saying? So you don't necessarily have to stay in that stance, because the stance, a lot of times you get guys that are running behind you when you're doing ball you man. You get guys that are creeping behind you.
Well, and so now to paraphrase a great song from the 80s, Midnight Star, no parking on the dance floor. No parking on the dance floor. So you talk about park behind a three-point line. Now watch how smart my guy is. I got this basketball man crush on this dude because he's just smart. Taurean Prince. Watch him at the break line on the right side as a Kelly Oubre. You mentioned he thought that Taurean Prince was going to spot up behind that three-point line at the break line. Watch what Taurean Prince does. This is a masterful job of cutting off ball. Let's run it. Here comes Taurean Prince. Oubre loses sight. Giannis, great drop. Boom, easy layup. We see this a lot from Taurean Prince, but you're right. You're thinking he's going to park behind that three-point line, but no, he fooled you on that one. Now, the final play. Take a look at this. Another just play. Just play action. Brooke going to set a – freeze it right there. Freeze it again. Freeze it on that screen. So Brooke did something that they call a varagile. And so I don't mind giving credit to the old school guy, or kind of the new old school guys, and Anderson Varejao with the Cleveland Cavaliers. They talked about how he would change the angle on those screens, and that's what Brooke did on that play.
Yeah,
we can run that back. Run that back again, Munnison. Watch Brooke.
Just slowly on the screen. Slowly.
Right there, it looks like Brooke freezes it there, like he's going to set it for Dame to go left. He changes it for Dame to go right. It totally flummoxes the defensive player guarding the screener. That's the help side. You don't know which way to go with the help. Dame gets a little bit of a head of steam as we run it through. Now watch again. We freeze it here. Dame is trapped. Dame is trapped right there. Two on the ball. Basic principle in basketball, get rid of it. Brooke, as the short roller, number two in the league, Chris, at points per possession as a short roller. Brooke Lopez, number one is Pascal Siakam. Brooke is number two doing this very maneuver. But once again, he's going to be in a situation where he's going to create a two-on-one, and that's all about making the right read. And Brooke is so good at 7'1", 290, on the move, making the right read. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think it's important that to identify that Brooke is also, you know, short rolling, but short rolling to the space that's open, not overrunning it, not just aimlessly running down, trying to get a piece of the paint and posting the guy up. There's a strategy involved. Brooke is using a high level of IQ on these short rolls and then finding the open guy.
He's a Stanford egghead. You would expect nothing less.
Nothing less from that dude.
From the eggheads. Watch the catch. What's going to happen? We freeze it here, and then there's a gamble that doesn't pay off. Look at that defender as it restricted. Who is that? That's Kyle Lowry. And who's he guarding? Bobby Portis. That's 6 feet and old, 37 years old, 6 feet and old against a 6'11 Bobby Portis. And so it's just playing. It's just playing, and so we run it. You got something first?
Go ahead, run it through and watch the pass. Now, I'm curious, MJ, on your thoughts. Sure, that's the right basketball play, but in today's NBA, would it have been the right basketball play to try to hit Gary Trent for an open three? Do we want that two, that sure two, or do we want Trent for that open three?
Well, it's all about layups and threes. You know, right. Those are your most efficient shots in terms of points per shot. You know, free throws, I think, is still number one, I believe, but the layup is number two. Then that 3-point shot, that open three, and so yeah, that would have been fine if Brooke would have decided based on how Kyle Lowry had played that possession. But you know, when you got the sure two with Bobby Portis inside against Kyle Lowry, I'm fine.
And time and score. You know, 107, 12-point game, five minutes to go. Let's put them away. You know, I think the mentality comes into play on that too.
Keep the scoreboard moving. You know, exactly. Jim Paschke, my old partner before Lisa Byington and her fine work that she does. But Jim Paschke, his thing, his philosophy on twos or threes, do what you got to do to keep the scoreboard moving in a situation like that. Just keep the scoreboard moving. So now, and then you know how it is as a player. So it's now instead of being down 12, you look up, you're down 14. You've given up a layup right at the rim. You're Kyle Lowry. Yeah, it sucks. It sucks. It's fine. You know, this is the time of the game where my old assistant coach, John Killalay, this is an old a cow rancher term. It's nut cutting time. You know, it's nut cutting time. You can imagine where he got that from. But this is that point in the game. It's nut cutting time where you got to make the right decisions. You got to make the right plays, and you've got to execute and also capitalize on these situations. So as long as you keep the scoreboard moving, I don't have a problem with that. If we run it through, Bobby's gonna abuse little Kyle Lowry inside. And once again, there's the trap. Look at the replay. Get it out of your hands quickly. Bad
good
gamble.
Hands by Brooke.
Yeah, you know, good, great hands. Great job, Caleb Martin. Bad decision to try and gamble. Just no way Lowry's going to make an impact. And you talk about a 3-point shot. He gets an opportunity for an old-fashioned 3-point play just based on him dominating and attacking the smaller Kyle Lowry right in the restricted area. So, you know, about that action, it's all about read and react right now. And I think if you get guys to buy into that, which these guys are doing, it's nothing new. Coach Bud had a series of offensive stuff called random, where it was the same thing, just random. He called it random. Okay, guys, we're just random. And you're just reading and reacting off of each other. And it takes a certain level of player IQ to pull it off. It takes a certain level of skill, package to be able to find out what the advantages are. But man, if you could do it like this, you know, calling and your opinion on this, do you see a bunch of different offensive sets, or is everybody kind of running the same thing in transition? You center the ball to the big guy, he hits to the left side, goes and screens. I mean, it's a lot of just duplication, you know, for lack of a better word, in offense.
Yeah, there is a lot of duplication in offense. It's a copycat league, but I think that the nuance comes when you got the certain type of players with the IQ to read and react. Like, it sounds like an easy thing to do, but every team in the league, every roster, you go down the league, offensively, the bad teams are not going to be your terribly high IQ guys.
Right.
But this Bucks team has a bunch of those type of guys. And what we saw in that first game is that they're not letting, you know, if a defense takes away the first or second option, there's always three, four, five. They're getting to different options. I love the new emphasis on read and reaction. I mean, it worked to a T the first game. Let's see how long they're going to continue this. This is how it have to be a lifestyle for the Bucks moving forward.
And that's a good point. Got to be a lifestyle. And I got to give a shout out to this guy right here. We talk about Greg Buckner and what he's done with the defense. But I tell you what, man, Dave Yeager. Dave Yeager, former head coach in Memphis. They brought him in as an assistant to get the defense straight in Memphis when Z-Bo and all those guys were down in Memphis. And he went from a mid 18th ranked defense to a top defense every year that he was down there running the defense. Then he became head coach. Now he's the offensive coordinator. So people are like, well, he was a defensive guy. Well, you know, when you're coaching great defense, you've got to be in tune to everything offensively an opponent can throw at you. And so Dave has been responsible, and he is a maestro in practice, Chris, watching him stop possession, stop execution, just to point out what you could have done. Here are your options. Doc does a great job of that, too. I mean, he gives these guys, they got options. There's no one way to do something. You see what the defense is going to do, and then you take advantage of whatever that defender commits to. So read and react, I think, is the way to go right now for the Bucks. And I think even when Chris comes back, even when they're running more half-court type offense, that they'll be able to – I think the majority of the game is going to be 60, 70% of the game offensively. It's going to be just kind of – just playing off each other. Read and react, spacing, you know, all that good stuff.
I agree. When Chris comes back, they'll be even more lethal, in my opinion, on read and react because of the attention that he will – attract and the spacing that he creates. Last thing on this physicality. We've been hearing about it all preseason from Doc Rivers on the defensive end. Against the Sixers, did you see a difference in the Bucks' physicality from this first game to what you saw last season?
Honestly, I can't say I saw an appreciable difference, but I just know that overall in that first game, after the first 7 to 8 minutes of that first quarter, it was that first game jitters and guys were playing a little bit too fast and kind of hyped up. Once they settled down, I got this methodical, business-like approach that you've got to have to be a great team in this league. There's so many games, 82 games scheduled, you know, so many great players, so many great teams. You can't get up and fired up and hyped up for every single game. It's impossible to do. So now you've got to find that level of methodical, just execution, methodical, picking teams apart, having them play your style, imposing your will on the game. And I think I saw that from the second quarter on. The Bucks at both ends, offensively, defensively, just did a masterful job. I think Tyrese Maxey shot 30 shots and scored 25 points.
did a good job on him.
He's going to get his points. But if it takes him 30 shots to get there, you've done your job on him. So
Last point, rebounding. The Bucks kind of got in the first half. Now, you made a good point. Second half, we saw a change in the business-like approach, more attention to detail, especially on the glass. But there were some moments there, some possessions where Philly fought three or four offensive rebounds in a row. Do you think this is going to be an issue moving forward?
Well, it's an anomaly because, you know, Andre Drummond is the best offensive rebounder, one of the best in the history of the game. He had 5 offensive rebounds out of his 13. But 17 offensive rebounds is way too much. And so, and that's been a recurring theme in the exhibition season at times also. So it's something that, and it's not just, you know, Giannis going to get his 10 to 12, but you need the guards, Gary Tritt, to get those long rebounds, Torian Prince to get in there and dig some out. Damian Lillard had, what, nine rebounds, I want to say, last night? You know, so that's the kind of effort that you're going to need. It's got to be a group effort to rebound the basketball. One last point that I wanted to talk about quickly, and I'm excited about, is that the Milwaukee Bucks ownership is talking about the WNBA.
Oh, bringing the does back. We started that. We started that conversation months ago. You remember?
The Milwaukee does.
You brought it up. Yeah. I remember that.
Yeah, yeah. And so I went to a lot of dough. Well, you know, let me, you know, transparency. Maybe went to three or four dough. But that was a lot back in those days.
That's a lot, bro.
In the dead of winter, to get out of my house.
In the early 80s?
Get out of my house in Glendale and the areas that I lived in and to head downtown and all that. Yeah, trust me. That was taking my life in my own hands back in those days. But that's exciting. I'm excited about that. And just, you know, before we end here, District, for this week, I haven't tapped into it like I probably should have. Did you have an issue with the way the championship was gifted to the Liberty, as some people put it, or do you have any issue with the foul calling and the lack of a traveling violation against Breonna Stewart at the end? I mean, what would your take on that?
I mean, you know, it was pretty egregious to not call that travel. The foul is another story. I kind of thought she got hit on that, but I think the travel was really blown. So before we even get to the foul, for her, just, I mean, it's one thing to kind of, you know, take a couple of steps, you know, couple of whatever, but just like five steps before you dribble the ball, I felt like, you know, that was a call the official should have made. But hey, officials blow calls all the time. This one just happened to be in the biggest moment in the WNBA history.
Did that put a taint on the greatness of the league this year at all in your mind?
No, it doesn't, because, you know, what, one play is going to taint all the fabulous performances and all the big time, you know, teams and everything that we saw from the league. Yeah. The league has gone through unprecedented growth. There's another league coming out of that they're bidding on right now, trying to get Caitlin Clark to play. It's just, women's basketball is at an all time high. So what? Like, that's an anomaly. I mean, hey, can you think of an NBA final where a call was missed or blown like that caused another team to win? Can you think of one? Can you go back in that deep memory bank of yours, M, and come up with something for me on the fly, put you on the spot?
No, I just remember the great Johnny Most, when the ball was being inbounded, and I think it was Sam Jones that kind of deflected it, and John Havlicek picked it up, and Havlicek stole the ball. Well, it actually should have went to Sam Jones, but that's me nitpicking. So, but other than that, no. Sam Jones stole the ball. No, Havlicek steals the ball.
How about this?
It was actually Sam Jones that actually jarred the ball loose, and Havlicek.
Let me give you one that was obvious. Our guy, MJ, Michael Jordan.
Okay. The push off of Brian Russell.
He literally.
And that's like, that's a missed call. Yeah.
That's a missed call. That's blatant. Offensive foul.
Oh, wow. That's a swallow your whistle. Because Brian Russell actually kind of stumbled and went down to the ground. The MJ pushed him so hard. But, that's a great call right there, pointing that one out. Yeah. But to your point, the WNBA hopefully comes to Milwaukee. And, you know, we're right on the travel schedule. Chicago is just less than 2 hours away, and quick flight or whatever. So geographically, things would work out.
Hey, Indiana's Clark, close Angel by. Reeves, oh, man, right around man. The corner, bro.
Yeah,
come
yeah,
on.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it would really be good. And we should try and get Arike Ogunbowale. If we could make a trade to get her in here, you know,
high
school sensation. Where'd she go? Notre Dame, high school sensation in
Milwaukee.
That'd
be incredible.
Some parochial school that is too long for me to pronounce that she went to in Milwaukee. But, man, I love watching her play. So I'm down for it, man. Let's bring that WNBA to Milwaukee, and let's get this thing cracking. So anyway. All right, man. Look, man, this is it, man. The fantastic voyage. The season has started. The ship has left the port. And we'll see how smooth the sailing is. And I think it's just going to be one exciting ride. And we'll be right there here, District, to give it to you each and every week. And Enjoyed it, man. Good show this week, man. Good job.
Yes, sir. Appreciate you, Ed.
All right. Here, District, Marcus Jackson, Chris Jackson. Join us next time.
This has been a Bucks Plus audio production.